Ken, I want to focus kind of on the better side of the 60s. I was just wondering, what did you like to do, or what did the public, around you like to do as leisure activities, entertainment, anything like that?
Pretty much the same things that you see now, really. Pardon me, in Florida, going to the beach is a big thing. I enjoyed doing that then very much. I still do when I'm in Florida.
Now it's snow time.
Snow time and the snow sports and everything. Pretty much the same things, really. I think your mother and I used to go out dancing a couple times a month, or once a month anyway. Go out at least one night a month to have an evening out to eat, and maybe go dancing for a little bit. Do things like that. Go ahead.
What kind of music was popular, or who did you like to listen to, or what was the guy or the girl that was the popular one?
Oh gosh, there's so many of them.
That you think was the most popular?
Well, at the time it was going on, a lot of people didn't like him. I think they made some very, very beautiful music, because the Beatles, a lot of people my own age thought I was crazy. How could you like a group like that?
Yeah.
Well, it's the same thing that my parents said to me in 1955 when Bill Haley and the Comets came out with the first real rock and roll band ever, and Chuck Berry, and all these guys you hear the music for now in this day and age. Mm-hmm. Hey, I was as much into that as you guys are into metal music and all the other different things.
Yeah.
That was my era. It wasn't my mom and dad.
Yeah.
And the music that you guys like now, or came along through the time when your brother was born and you were born, that's your music.
Yeah.
And I do understand that, because I went through the same thing with my parents.
Yeah.
What I should or shouldn't like. Yet my dad loved Dixieland jazz, which I loved all my life. And your mom and I go watch them play. If we found one, I used to like to go to the minor league hockey team there, then the Jacksonville Rockets.
Mm-hmm.
And watch them play hockey a couple nights a week if we could, or one night a week or a month. I got involved in the racing game many years ago, starting back around 1958. I rode drag motorcycles for a shop out of Fort Myers, Florida, which we campaigned all over the country. Drag racing, I did it for money. Didn't make any, hardly. But it was done professionally at my expenses.
Mm-hmm. And that's scary.
It was scary, but then you don't think you can ever get hurt.
And
your lifespan's 400 years long, and you don't worry about those things. But then the dull reality, or the reality of life, comes along with children and responsibilities, and then you have to curtail them, those desires, for a time.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess one of the satisfying things, I enjoyed a lot of things. I liked the outdoors tremendously. I've always been a car nut, mainly because my father was an automobile dealer. From the end of the Second World War, and I was exposed to those things. But I always loved competition and playing football and anything competitive. And I got involved in the racing game, starting then. And it's funny, in 1958, my father and my sister V and myself went to Sebring to watch part of the 12 hours of Sebring. And I remember standing here at pit 16 in the back of it and seeing that number. And their old European style pits are very small. We were standing behind that, and the Jaguar team was in there. I just looked at my dad and said, well, someday I'm going to win this race. And by golly, it was, I say 78, it was 25 years later, 1983, darn if we didn't win it. Now, that's something that you very rarely ever see. It was kind of like a pipe dream, but something I always thought about. And
goosebumps when it happened.
Oh, everything. Every thought in the world runs through your mind. You realize something that you dreamed about, I mean, really dreamt about. You were too young, of course, then. You were only, 10 years old then.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't even get you near a pit area, so there's no reason to take you there. There's nothing you could have done.
Mm-hmm.
But your brother Mike was there, and that was a very satisfying thing that my son was with me, or one of my sons was with me at the time. And it was just funny, ironic, great, wonderful. And I asked my sister B, your Aunt B, she remembered that. She said, oh, it's plain as day.
Yeah.
Once it became reality, she just couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
But that's one of the nice things from the competition that came out. And we went to Sebring. We first started running there in 1979. I picked out that number 16 pit, and we got to keep it all those years up until we won.
Oh, yeah.
And even in 1984 and 85, we had it.
Yeah.
But we didn't win anymore there. No. We finished many times very close to the top.
It's kind of a thrill to finish anyway.
Just to finish the race alone and make it, that 12-hour race at Sebring is harder than any 24-hour race any other place in this world.
Yeah.
That 12 hours is the toughest race, in the endurance race in the world. And I'm very proud of that. And that's, I really, really enjoyed that. And a lot of that to do with my desire of competition, loving cars and race cars, and having, it was kind of like a family thing, because one of my sons, your brother, had a chance to participate in this in Canada and West Virginia and in Florida and all over the place, where I was able to take him with me. And it's where I took you to Daytona that particular time. You got to see the NASCAR guys testing from the real side of the track, where you could, how fast they really go and what the people are like and all that.
What was like the fashion like, you know, in the 60s? And it's probably funny to go back and look at it, but, you know, did you...
Oh, yeah, it was so different. Well, the short hair was still hanging around the mid-60s, and I wore a flat top, and the only reason I didn't that day and age, and I kept it afterwards, when I played football, I could not wear long hair with a football helmet. I never could, and I never liked to, and it was too uncomfortable. But you can see around 1964, 65, the hairstyles changing, and then along come the Beatles. Along came the Beatles. And that changed everything. And the hippie generation started, the movement and so on. And like overnight, the 2-inch wide ties, little narrow ties, became 8-inch wide ties that went out of fashion 10 years before that. And I never threw my ties away, thank God, because they've recycled 3 times now in the last 25 years. But the hair styles changed. I thought it was terrible. The sideburns, I thought it was terrible. And if you take a look at pictures now, this many years later, some of the guys, my friends that wore it like that, say, did I really look like that? But that was a time. And I think too much emphasis was put on it, too, when you stop and think about it. I never had a friend that was any less friendly or any more friendly because his hair hung down to his shoulders.
Yeah.
And not every person that wore his hair to his shoulders or to the middle of his back was an excessive or a drug user, period.
Yeah.
That was a sign of the times. That was a rebellion against the establishment, all the crap that was going on then with the Vietnam War and all the different things that were happening. Sure it was. It was a wonderful protest. It was probably as peaceful a protest you could ever have.
Yeah.
But maybe we were all a little too ignorant when it first started. I think I grew up a lot from that as a person. I probably had an easier time through that as anybody could have or expect to have. But you get exposed to so many things and you start growing up. You start learning. People aren't blind. They don't, like I said before, they just don't blindly follow the other guy around anymore. They want to know why, how, when, where. Like I was, they try to teach me in seventh grade social study. Who, what, when, why, how, and where, and all the different questions you always ask about a subject, about a person, about a thing. And that's very encouraging this day and age. You no more would react the way I did then, now, if those same circumstances came up. People of your generation are too darn smart, and very few people in this world want to give the younger generations any credit for having brains or intelligence. And people are so generally smarter than I was at that time, exposed to more, better teaching. And everybody's being accused of not having as good of instruction this day and age, but I think it's better than it's ever been. And there's more availability of different subjects and different items you can go after now than you could when I was a child or I was a young man. I envy the young people this day and age. Yeah. I really do.
Well, I don't know, you kind of said a little bit about it before about fashion. Do you think go ahead.
Yeah, the bell bottoms. Oh, jeez. Everybody got them. It was kind of an everybody thing, and I did an everybody on everything. Mm-hmm. I thought, I'll try a pair of those bell bottoms. That's probably the worst thing is, I remember my dad saying when they came out, they wore bell bottoms in the middle 20s. And the guys that wore them, the name for them were cake eaters. Now that doesn't make any sense to anybody in this day and age, and didn't to me either. But my dad said, now you know what a cool cat is? I said, yeah, that's what a cake eater was. Same meant the same thing as being a cool cat. It means nothing to me, but it did to him in that day and age and era. And the styles. He said the way your hair was combed, what angle it was combed back, meant something. And just like the big DAs and duck's ass haircuts. I used to have long hair in the back in high school, and I comb it in when I went to school, and before I come home, I comb my hair straight down. My mother couldn't see it.
Yeah.
I was protesting then and didn't even realize it.
Yeah.
But the fashions really changed in the 60s. They really did. The wild, long look, the unkempt look. I don't care what happened, I always like to shine my shoes. I wasn't going to wear any muddy boots into church or anything like that. Some of the things I didn't want to give up. But some of the fashions I did change about myself.
What about like any TV shows or anything like that? Is there a certain show you like to watch?
Gosh, yeah. Sergeant Bilko. The Three Stooges forever.
I used to watch them.
That's, I think, one of the things that a few people then and now, don't really appreciate a stupid belly laugh just to laugh for the sake of laughing and loosening up and just have a good laugh.
Yeah.
And that's what I really looked for. When I wanted to laugh or be entertained, I didn't want to be taught anything. I just wanted to relax and laugh. And that's what entertainment's for, to forget the other side of life and just...
Yeah, need a lot of that.
The music changed drastically. I've always liked. I had a chance, and when I was a 12-year-old, to go see South Pacific with the original cast in it in New York with my parents. That set the tone for me liking the theater as much as I did, and the show music, Broadway music, that type of music. It had a lasting effect on me. I'd never thought anything about it until I experienced it in person. You got to see Ezio Pinza and Mary Martin.
Yeah.
We were center stage, third row from the stage. Yeah. And got to see one of the greatest, longest running plays in the history of the American theater. And it changed my thoughts on music and a lot of things. And it taught me to appreciate all the different types of music. It sure did help when we got into the 60s, because there was 50 different types of music being thrown at you.
Yeah.
And the groups, the rock music, the concerts, and all that.
Yeah.
It was a wild, wide open, tumultuous time. It was really, really, it was really some time to be alive.
Who was your idol back then? Do you remember?
Oh, God. Do you know who it was? And you might laugh. Bishop Fulton J. Sheen, a Catholic bishop that was on TV quite a bit. And he talked about religion. He was probably the greatest orator or speaker I've ever heard in my entire life. He made a lot of sense and a lot of practical views toward religion and toward life, period. As a matter of fact, we know an actor, Martin Sheen, father of Charlie Sheen and Emilio Estevez, which his name is Estevez. And at the time, when he was seeking a stage name, as you know, his name is Martin Sheen.
Yeah.
He took the last name of Bishop Fulton J. Sheen because he respected him so much and he really loved to listen to him. And I think he picked up a lot of his acting habits from the speaking. That was an idol. That's a man I truly, truly, truly respected. And the man that was my priest, the Episcopalian priest in my church, was a Shakespearean actor from England originally, before he became an Anglican priest. There's another one of my idols. Maybe it's because of their ability to speak and get across ideas. My idols, I respected them tremendously. That, and of course, that day and age, a lot of people. I thought the world of Dwight D. Eisenhower. And why I liked him so much is how he got all those different countries together and that coalition of people and the Allied command, and him being the head guy, and how he got them all pulling together in the same direction at one time. That was a monstrous task, and he accomplished it. I respect a lot of people then, but the one that sticks out in my mind as much as my dad is Fulton J. Sheen. I just can't say enough about him. To help the ongoing consciousness that you have out of life. Your parents help create a conscience in you. And he nurtured it and helped it push it along a little more, really. But I really did. That was one of my idols.
All right, this is going to conclude my interview with Dave Sorensen. I thank you very much for helping me out.
more than welcome.